Mr. President, members of the faculty, members of the university, ladies and gentlemen, I am very grateful for your kind words of welcome. For a Prime Minister of Great Britain to be invited to your great university is an unusual occasion. But I feel sure that my present office was not the only, or indeed perhaps the main reason for your invitation. My real claim to be here is on account of my birth, or at least on one side of it. For I am half Scots and half American. The first, you may or may not think to be an advantage. I remember reading in one of Lord Chesterfield's letters the following passage about another Prime Minister, not a very popular one, who also came from my country, Lord Bute. He said that the great cry against Lord Bute was on account of his being a Scotsman, the only one of his many faults that he could not possibly correct. But whatever you may feel about my father's origin, I feel sure you will have no hesitation about my mother's. Like my great predecessor in office, and the greatest of living and perhaps of all Englishmen, Sir Winston Churchill, I took the precaution on entering life to make sure to be born of an American mother. And not only American, but Hoosier. For my mother's father, Joshua Bellis, as you heard, was one of the first graduates at DePoer's Medical School. My mother was born in the state of Indiana, I think in Indianapolis. I was able to visit Spencer, where she lived all her life, till she left America two years ago, and to attend service in the Methodist Church in whose choir she used to sing. In those early days, of course, when my grandfather first came to Indiana, life was very different. Indiana was still a pioneer state. Your university was only just beginning the fine tradition which it has followed since. But I can assure you that I am proud to be associated with DePoer University, and so to renew an old family connection. I have chosen today as the theme of my address to you who are about to graduate into the world the word interdependence. For it is my belief that this word must be the keynote of the second half of the 20th century if the progress of humanity is to continue. But before I come to its wider applications, I would like to say a word about its meaning in the life of scholarship and learning. There can be no better example of interdependence than the relationship which exists between the universities of the United States and of Great Britain. It was from British stock that the first teachers of your universities came. It was upon our tradition that you built. For all our history belongs to you. It is yours. The English Bible, the deep religious conviction of our ancestors, Shakespeare, the English common law, all these are yours by right of inheritance, brought to this continent by your ancestors. And thus, in the early years of learning, the science and knowledge of the old world flowed across the Atlantic to enrich your scholarship. And now, for a long time, there has been a double flow. Today, scholars in our two countries, in the arts, in science, in medicine, and all other branches work together to their mutual benefit. Here, at least, there are no barriers. Of course, in the last 100 years, the world has shrunk. When your first teacher, Mr. Nutt, came to Greencastle from Pennsylvania, it took him 16 days. It would not take him now as many hours. But if the world has shrunk, are we sure that human mentality and outlook have widened in due proportion? It is, of course, a trite observation to say that we live in a period of transition. Many people have said this at many times. Adam may well have made the remark to Eve on leaving the Garden of Eden. But there can never have been a time in our history when it has been so true, when all forms, the material forms of progress, have advanced with such startling and breathtaking rapidity. And are we sure that we have made sufficient adaptations in our outlook on political and economic questions to keep pace? In a word, are the statesmen running behind the scientists? Of course, in a sense, the statesmen have the more difficult task. For science, whether pure or applied, is of its nature international. It has no boundaries. And accept a truth, no responsibilities. The scientist and the technician devise new methods of locomotion, new sources of power, and new methods of destruction on an ever-increasing scale. It is no part of their duty to say what use mankind will make of these novel and often terrifying instruments. They proceed along their chosen path, making one deduction from another, adding discovery to discovery, and leave it there. And nevertheless, all these processes may revolutionize the whole life of man on earth. After the First World War, a sense of shock at the appalling destruction and misery caused by that conflict made many statesmen and people begin to think in terms outside the old pattern of national states and make a move along the path to world unity. But the First League of Nations broke down, and for two reasons. First, it was not comprehensive. And second, it was armed with no sufficient cohesion or power. It was a noble and bold effort to produce, in Pascal's words, a world in which force is just and justice has force at its disposal. But alas, the dream could not be realized. And when the test came, the League broke under the strain. After the Second World War, which had inflicted sorrow and destruction upon an even greater scale and over an even wider field throughout Europe and Asia alike, a new attempt was made. And in the first flash of enthusiasm, the founders of the United Nations believed that they had found the answer. In the Security Council, mainly dominated by the great powers, was to be found the germ of a world administration or cabinet, and in the Assembly, the beginning of a world congress or parliament. But once again, events have proved too strong for us. To make anything like a world community all at once has been too big a step. And this time, the attempt has foundered on the deep division in the world between two different concepts of society of government, of man himself, and of man's relation to his creator. And so there has grown between two great blocks of nations the division, which we roughly call the division between the free world and the communist world. There are some who feel that this struggle is necessarily fated to end either in war or in the triumph of revolutionary communism. I believe that to be far too pessimistic a judgment. Of course, the free world must be firm, as well as fair. We must not lower our guard. We must not fall victim to propaganda or to mere exhaustion. Nor must we delude ourselves by wishful thinking. We must not conceive of peace as a state of inactivity, something that can just be enjoyed. It is rather something that has to be won by struggle and effort. Nevertheless, in the long view, I cannot believe that a country like Soviet Russia, developing so rapidly in all the technical, scientific, and material improvements of life, will not, in due course, be subjected to the normal development of all civilized peoples. As the revolution sinks further and further into the background, as the period of mass murder and torture and revolutionary methods becomes more and more remote, as the standard of the people rises, surely these very intelligent people will not be content forever with what is called the materialist doctrine. Sooner or later, however strong or coercive the central government, these men and women will begin to ask themselves the questions that man has always posed since first he came into the world. These questions may now be illegal or suppressed or believed not worth the asking. Yet sooner or later they will ask themselves the old questions and search for the answers. Who made us? Why are we here? What is the purpose of life? Is there right and wrong? Is there sin? Is there God? This will not come about if we in the free world lose our own faith. But if we hold on to our faith, I am persuaded that this day will come. These two great forces do not always face themselves directly across an empty arena. On the contrary, the so-called uncommitted countries, neither for us nor against, comprise enormous numbers, and their role may well be vital. Naturally, in the countries of Asia and Africa, new forces are at work. At first, these are apt to take crude and dangerous shapes. But nationalism and national pride is in itself a healthy thing. It is only wrong when it is twisted into aggression. And certainly we in Britain have considerable experience of these changes. And we have not been unresponsive to this new challenge. For over 100 years, it has been the policy of Great Britain to develop her colonies and dependencies into free and independent nations. Since the end of the war, this process has been extended to peoples not of British stock. And thus, we have transformed empire into commonwealth. Of our own will and design, we have set up in freedom great countries like India, Pakistan, Ceylon, and recently Ghana and the Malay states, other new nations like the West Indian Federation, who will shortly join these ranks. I call them ranks, but there is no military discipline which keeps the Commonwealth together. It is not now, even in all cases, even the tie of the crown. It is certainly not unity of creed or color or race. Nevertheless, it is a real unity of the Commonwealth, based on old traditions common to our country and to yours. It is the tradition of government by debate and discussion, of committees and parliaments. It is the principle of the independence of the judiciary, the freedom of the individual, the universality of law. The ultimate success of the free world will perhaps depend on the degree to which we can spread these ideals to the hesitating and uncommitted countries. When I last had the privilege of meeting with President Eisenhower in Washington, a few months ago, we drew up together a declaration of common purpose. You might almost call it a blueprint for interdependence. It was not a visionary project, but a practical advance to bring the reality of our alliance up to date. It was not meant to establish a kind of exclusive club, but to set the pattern for a wider group, to show why it is that the Soviet Union has satellites, while we in the free world have allies. Interdependence is already a reality. In the field of defense, it is becoming more and more effective. I believe that if we can develop it further on the political field and in economic matters as well, then the cohesion of the free world will be so strong and its attraction so great that the threat to our way of life will decline as the years pass by. No one who has studied the Marxist writers can fail to be impressed by the emphasis placed on destructive criticism of the capitalist system. Our world, which we see as prosperous and free and happy, is represented by the Marxists as a jungle filled with ravening beasts seeking to devour each other. A jungle in which there is bound to be starvation for the many and plenty only for the few. Violent trade cycles and war are said to be the inevitable products of our system. Of course, we know that this is an utterly false view. Nevertheless, two things are true, which we have not yet all learned. First, prosperity, like peace, is indivisible. And secondly, there are still too many artificial barriers to the free flow of money and trade in the free world. These barriers, of course, have grown up historically when modern civilization and material progress were in their infancy. Indeed, when the political aims of the different countries in the free world were different. When the great alliances had not been forged, why then it was natural that governments should pursue separate and conflicting economic policies. But now all our political aims are the same. We differ, if at all, on tactics and not on strategy. We all face a common danger. Just as the economies of the states of the Union on this continent grew together 200 years ago, so, in some measure at least, must the economies of the free world today. Since the war, the United States has, with unexampled generosity, poured out its treasure all over the world. First, to help its allies who are impoverished in the joint defense of freedom, and then to foster and protect the young economies of the newly independent states. All too little credit has been given for this. Indeed, often you have found ingratitude. We in Britain, with our far smaller resources, have played our full part in this work. And of course, by now, we have learned not to expect gratitude. You would not expect me today to try to go into any detail as to how all this is to be done. It would indeed be impertinent on my part, even if I had sufficient knowledge. It is, in a sense, a job for the experts. But it is also the job of the statesman to inspire and command the experts. I have no doubt that over here, you, like we, suffer from a plethora of economic advisors and statisticians. I remember somebody in my country once describing a statistician as a man who was dead on time. Well, we have to live and build while we have the time, a fuller and freer world for ourselves. We've got to see that not only our military alliances, but our political thought and economic policies match up to the level of the great scientific and technical advances which the world has made. Whether it be in a great commonwealth like ours, or a great continent like yours, we can no longer afford to think parochially. What is it, then, that the United States and Britain stand for? We stand to defend and to spread, by all legitimate means, what we call the free way of life. This seems to us the right way, both morally and materially. Sometimes we wonder why any countries outside the Soviet control can hesitate. In fact, there is perhaps less doubt and hesitation than sometimes we think. All the same, these people want to be sure that our claims are justified. And how are we to convince them, as well as to fortify ourselves? The free world cannot defend itself or win allies to itself only by rockets and bombers and all the rest. These are necessary, but they are not enough. In the long run, the free world will defend itself and win adherence to itself because our way of life gives a better way of living, a fuller life to the individual, security and hope.